Hello, and welcome to Unstuffing Our Story with me, Catrice Horsley. On today's episode, I'm interviewing an incredibly interesting woman, Ateya Mahinyach, who is a criminologist and an expert in crime prevention through environmental design. And she talks about ways that we can enable neighbourhoods and communities to change their story. And sometimes it can start in the most simple way, to do with the physicality of the neighbourhood, bringing people together to change the physicality, developing relationships within those groups that come together, and then changing the story. So please join me as we listen to Ateya Mahinyach unstuff her story. Welcome, Ateya, to Unstuffing Our Story. Did I say your name right?
Almost, very close.
Okay, tell
it's
me.
Ateya.
So. Ateya. You Ateya. Have the E on the Ateya.
Close enough.
And your surname, yeah. Just remind me, because I have got it written phonetically as Mahinyach.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's Mahinyach. That's the way we say it. Very good.
So welcome, Ateya Mahinyach. I'm so happy that you agreed to come on, because not only do I think you're an inspirational human and an inspirational woman, and especially today on International Women's Day when we're actually recording this, which is rather wonderful, but it's to do with you offering a really different perspective about the concept of stories, cultural narratives, community narratives, and neighborhood narratives in the work that you do. So just for the listeners, we met in New Orleans. How many years ago was that?
I think it's about, is it about 4 years now?
Yeah, it's a while, isn't it?
Time flies. Yeah,
and
exactly.
It was while you were working there, and I was invited in, and I remember the work that you did, and I also remember the food in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I possibly remember those in equal amounts.
Yeah. Well, we definitely had a lot of fun, so... combining the basically the work with pleasure, right? I mean, that's what it's all about.
It is, and it's wonderful when your work gives you pleasure as well. Mm-hmm. So I often ask the guests just to kind of share the story of how they got to where they are now. So how did you get to being a criminologist and what is it, crime prevention through environmental design expert? How did you get to be where you are now? And tell people where you're sitting as well. What country?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, I'm currently situated in my home country, Slovenia. So I'm in the capital of Ljubljana, capital of the country of Ljubljana. I've had a pleasure of being able to live overseas as well and travel, and that actually led me to where I am today. So, when we met each other in New Orleans, like you said, that was actually the time when I was just situated in Australia, where I was studying and doing some work as well. So we did some project work in Australia, in New Zealand, as well as then in North America, primarily the US, but Canada as well. So, you know, that exposure actually gave me a really good overview of how things are done differently, how neighborhoods are different between different continents, right? I mean, now we're doing also work in Europe now, and I'm back here. I'm kind of almost like reconnecting with what's going on here, but a lot has changed also since I left. Basically, the way I got into the field was initially I was very much interested in kind of crime and policing aspect of helping people. And then I even wanted to join the police force at some point. And then I continued studying. Then I decided to also go studying in Australia. And I kind of realized I can probably do much more by actually preventing it rather than treating the issue, the symptoms. So I think that's what really attracted me in kind of continuing exploring, you know, how can we prevent it? How can we focus on developing communities where they can actually be part of that, those efforts as well? Because we shouldn't just rely on the police. They can't be everywhere. And also we don't want them to be everywhere. You know, people are like, police are blamed for being there and they're blamed for not being there. So, you know, it's never right. And yeah, like the more I researched, the more, I guess, the path led me to crime prevention through environmental design, which is an approach that looks at both physical and social environment of preventing crime and provides some tactics as well as the processes of including the community and different actors as well.
I think you saying that there's a kind of paradox in those neighborhoods that quite often need the most work regarding crime prevention are often the neighborhoods where the people who live there believe that their voice matters the least. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I was brought up in a challenging area. I loved it. You know, it was called home. I knew it. But a lot of us felt that we wouldn't challenge a doctor, we wouldn't challenge anybody who was a professional because they were better than us. And we didn't feel that our voices had any worth, or that we, you know, as kind of working class people, had much value. And there was a lot of crime in that area. But we wouldn't have even thought we had the power to change it, because our belief was that we were pretty powerless within that society. So I'm wondering, in your work, how do you enable those communities and those neighborhoods to feel that their story and their voice is valued and has worth and power?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's a very important point, Catrice, because I've noticed that, like I said, I had a pleasure of working across different continents, and we can see how, I mean, in Europe, we're quite lucky to live in fairly safe, you know, cities and countries. But for example, in places, there are some cities in, for example, the USA that are very dangerous because there's a lot of violence, gang violence and so on. And people have to, like, they have no choice but actually getting engaged, because they can't often even rely on the government to offer or provide certain resources. There's a lot of talk about trusting the government and institutions and so on. What about the other way around, right? We also need to make sure that the government trusts its people, that they are not, maybe they are not, you know, experts in particular fields, but they definitely have life experience, they have opinions, they are experts. We call that native intelligence. They have native intelligence about the area they live in. So they definitely have something to say. So, you know, and you are familiar with the work we do with Safe Growth. That is essentially what we're aiming at, because we're in Safe Growth, which is a kind of neighborhood safety planning method developed by Greg Saville. We have a team of about currently 10 people across across several continents. And we provide services, we train and empower people within the neighborhood to be able to, you know, to learn something, to give them skills to start learning, because it's all about them. It's about problem-based learning. They need to learn themselves. Mm. And I think about what they need to learn to address the problems that they have themselves identified. Mm. Because if we rely on outside experts, then they're also identifying the problems that they are. They look at crime statistics, they say, there's drug dealing, we're gonna look at that. But I mean, do we know who's involved? Why are they involved in drug dealing? You know, is it actually a problem? And so on. So we often don't have that information unless we look at the very local micro level and work with people who are there.
I love what you're saying, and I love the recognition that the local people are the experts in their lived stories. They are the experts in their lived stories. And I remember, you know, you talking about the trust and not relying on the government or local authorities to solve the problems. I remember when we were in New Orleans, there was a wonderful story about a neighborhood where there had been a lot of drug dealing. there had been drive-by shootings, and Safe Growth supported and trained and worked with members of the local community in trying to get the local authority to put some lighting in the areas where the drug deals were going down, because lighting is a big physical thing. And it was taking ages and ages, and the bureaucracy, and then the local authority was saying, we don't have the money and we won't do this. And then that group of people actually put the money together to put a security light on one person's house. And they'd agreed to have the light on their house. And so that light shone in that area where the drug dealing was happening. And that actually cut down where that, you know, that the drug dealing in that community. It might have moved it, I'm not 100% sure, but basically that neighborhood felt a lot safer and were empowered to make the change themselves. And I just remember thinking about how creative that was and how supportive Safe Growth was in enabling those people to take control themselves. Do you remember that story?
Certainly. I mean, we teach it a lot because so the story that you presented, and very good memory, by the way.
Thank you.
It's the Holy Grove. Well done. It's it's the Holy Grove neighborhood where following Hurricane Katrina, Greg was invited with the local AARP, which is I don't know the acronym, it's also changed, but it's looking at livability aspects of retired people, but people, it's also kind of encompassing everyone within the neighborhood. So together Greg was invited together with Jason Tudor, who was also leading the initiative in the neighborhood at the time, and you know Jason very well as well. So they basically trained and empowered, like you said, the residents there, you know, to also feel empowered in order to know that they can do something about it. Yeah. And the story about the light, that was basically because of the shootings and because of fear of crime, which we're also, you know, often looking at. It's just like, especially when you live in such a, you know, dangerous neighborhood as this was, like they had, I think, population of 4,000, and they had like, you know, 12 homicides by shooting a year, for example. That's terrible. So basically this was one of the projects, but what was more important was it wasn't just about providing lighting, because if you recall, that light was actually not by code, because they put together money and put the reflector light, or what do you call it, so the, you know, the very bright light that shouldn't be on the light pole. But the point was, what they were trying to achieve with that was also put some pressure on the politicians and say, we're here, we need that. If you're not going to do it for us, we're going to do it ourselves. So it actually attracted a lot of attention. And this then led to the official actually installing the actual proper lighting following that incident. So what we're talking about in Safe Growth, it's basically, as much as it is a community development and crime prevention approach, it is also a political movement. It's also a political, you know, pressure. And again, I don't want to talk about, you know, the officials and the city municipalities as being an enemy. Not at all. We need to work together. The idea is to have a collaborative approach, right? You know, they can't take over. Like, that's the idea, right? Let's have a collaboration. Let's have a discussion, discourse. Let's work together. That's how, you know, we can make the environment better for everyone.
I wanted to ask you, you were talking about at the start, some of the systemic issues that can cause poverty and cause people to turn to crime, and we need to kind of think, not just judge them because they're drug dealing, but look at why that's happening. And it reminds me of, you know, there's a load of old traditional stories of, say, a well, and people who drink from the well become ill, or a lake, quite often a lake where the water's disappearing and the people, you know, are really scared they're going to die because there's going to be no water left in the lake. And it ends up that there's some kind of serpent underneath the lake sucking it dry, and you have to kill the root. So I'm wondering, in the communities and neighborhoods that you've worked with, is there a pattern that appears in those communities that have the most need? Is there a pattern, you know, a serpent that they all share? Is there a challenge that they all share?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, first I want to emphasize that we often think of people who are, I mean, like, and I'm using inverted commas, problematic in our neighborhood. They're also part of our neighborhood. We can't, you know, say like they are the outsiders. They are, you know, they are the enemy. Like, they are part of us. So let's help them. Yeah. First, it's just kind of flipping the coin of not kind of vilifying certain groups, but thinking about how to best help them. And for example, even in criminology, we're often, especially in drug-related aspects, we're looking at, instead of kind of criminal justice enforcement approaches, towards more health-oriented approaches. And I think we need to think similarly when we talk about neighborhood crime prevention and, you know, community development type of work. But yeah, I mean, some of the common issues, definitely, even if we look at the work of the Chicago School in sociology, like from the 40s, 50s, you know, they identify that there are neighborhoods that have problems that are kind of endemic in those neighborhoods. So people can move out, but the problems stay within the neighborhood. So it's not people, it's the neighborhood. And in safe growth, which kind of borrows from the social ecology thinking, we talk about the unbalanced neighborhoods. It's just as the ecosystem can become unbalanced because there's too many kind of triggering events or you know, issues that become embedded in the neighborhood. In the same way, basically, you have unbalanced neighborhoods. So we need to kind of reach that equilibrium or try to make it more balanced. And yeah, and I mean, we often know that, like, when we look at certain neighborhoods that are considered problematic, we know that it's often concentration of inequality, poverty, you know, poor environment. Like, how, you know, how people feel so much better when they have even like the environment that they live in, that where they feel that they're respected, and people don't have the opportunities of, you know, improving their living conditions, because first, they don't have the skill. Second, they don't have the trust to be able to do it. So it's kind of that self-fulfilling prophecy. And people, basically, it's a self-perpetuating cycle of disadvantage and inequality as well. And just concentrating people who might have some challenges in one area, it's not going to work. Yeah. It creates imbalance.
Yeah. So. And that happens time and time again. This, and I'm using inverted commas, kind of ghettoization of certain areas.
I just wanted to add, like, of course, I mean, even, you know, look how even the government can help, for example. Like, the areas that are considered less desirable are usually also cheaper. So of course that people who may not have the means to be able to, you know, move in better areas are then going to move there. And of course, people then need to work two jobs to be able to survive their family. And, you know, they don't have time to spend with kids, for example, which, like, a good family unit is actually one of the protective factors for youth, for example. And so, you know, there's so many different intricate factors here that are intertwined that that need to be addressed kind of together. Also, we can't just say we're going to install the lights and that's going to solve the problem. And this is also something that we're very much, you know, warning about, even in crime prevention through environmental design or STEPDAD, because we often look at the design modifications, but like you said, it can shift or move the problem to another place. It might only temporarily affect it, and so on. So we need to look at those concurrently, how to maybe immediately achieve some good results and successes, and make sure that, you know, people are feeling safe as well as being safe instantly almost, But then also, how can we sustain that? How can we look at more root causes? And that's also how we approach it in Safe Growth, right?
We have our teams work. You did something that meant that people felt empowered quite quickly. And then that built up their confidence, and they were more likely to stay with the groups that were making the change because they'd seen quite a quick difference, quite a profound difference quite quickly. And so they were then invested in going deeper with the process. So I remember you talking about that, which was really, really interesting.
Yeah, those quick wins are so important. First, confidence. Second, they actually see that they are being taken seriously, that there is some shift happening. And third, you know, also when they work together, they actually want to see more change. And it's also about learning how to work together, because we can't neglect the importance of emotional intelligence as well when we talk about group work.
You know, I was just, as you were talking, I was thinking about the phrase intersectionality. And I know that we use intersectionality so much to describe individuals and how we're all layered out of stories, as I like to think of it. You know, I'm white, cisgendered, working class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that forms my identity. And I'm thinking there must be something to do with intersectionality of neighborhoods. And when you're talking about unpicking, like what the root causes are and dealing with stuff, everything is layered against everything. So you can't do one thing separately. It all has to, you have to be able to see where all the connections are for it to work. Is there such a thing as intersectionality for neighborhoods?
Yeah, I guess we could talk about it like that. Yeah, I love even when you showed a photo, I think of different woven
threads,
yeah, how they intersect and build the cohesive whole. Yeah, I think that's so important. And I've been quite critical of, kind of, I call them reductionist approaches to crime prevention, because we look at one approach, you know, addressing all the problems, or thinking that, like we said earlier, installing a light will solve all the problems. No, we need to look at, we need to be pragmatic first. So we need to look, be pragmatic. We need to select the approaches that work. And we also need to combine them, and we need to look at things holistically.
I'm going to ask you a question that I have a theory, which is probably wrong, but I have a theory. So I think there's an interdependency that exists in communities where there's poverty, because you have to rely on each other to, you know, borrow money from each other. If your vacuum cleaner breaks, to borrow somebody's vacuum cleaner. And in my community, you have people, kids normally, running backwards and forwards over the road because you'd had to borrow these things. And we even had a local shoplifter, professional shoplifter. I don't know whether we've been to university for it, but he was a professional shoplifter. And because you couldn't afford to buy certain stuff, you would put in orders to him, and he would steal it, and then you could buy it cheaper off him. So there was this whole ecosystem.
Wow. Organized crime.
The other thing that we had was, we had a really strong sense of community. You know, if somebody went down the road, my mom would look after their kids. If my mom had to go down the road, that neighbor would look after us. There was a sense that it wasn't the best community, but it was our community. And there would always be somebody there who would help you, always. There was a real strong sense of togetherness. When I moved up the social ladder, and I moved into middle class areas, and now I would have to describe myself as middle class, that sense of community wasn't there. And we would have community cohesion drives. We didn't know our neighbours. We wouldn't pop round because we didn't need to borrow from them. And you didn't want the shame when you got to that level of admitting that you didn't have money, because everybody in that area should have had money. Whereas the area that I came from, we all knew we had nothing. So how does that reflect in what you've seen with regards to communities that have strong relationships with each other, and then these kind of other communities where there's poverty, where that sense of community, those neighborhoods where there is a lot of poverty and crime, and that sense of community isn't there. What do you think makes the difference between a neighborhood mm-hmm. where there's a strong sense of community and a neighborhood where there isn't?
Yeah, I love this story because I like to look at the neighborhood community as a tribe in sort of, you know, kind of those interdependent relationships, a tribe that helps one another to survive. Yeah, I mean, and I think this is something that's probably also, unfortunately, has something to do with more individual focused, you know, community that has evolved in the Western world. A lot of us are, it's just, you know, me, I want to take care of myself and my family. So we probably have lost that sense of shared community and shared economy and so on, shared mentality basically about certain things. But differences, I mean, yeah, we have some very tight knit communities that are, you know, that are basically, when you look at the inverted commas objective indicators, they shouldn't be. They should be very disorganized in that, but there is some level of connection and so on. But mainly when we talk about cohesion, that's about shared trust and shared expectations. And if that exists, I think that's what makes it cohesive and, you know, people working together and wanting to collaborate and so on.
Perhaps the difference between those two neighborhoods, one that's got the strong sense of community and interdependency and one where there's so much crime, is the tipping of the balance between a number, a quantity of people who want to make the difference, outweighing those who don't. Perhaps there's like an optimum capacity or something that...
Well, you need a critical mass, I think.
That's the word exactly. I was looking for, critical mass. Optimum capacity. I knew that was not the right word.
Well, it's...
critical mass.
Optimal capacity. Well, I think it's about the same. Yeah. But it's, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in any movement, I think you need that critical mass of people who are willing to, and not just willing to, but also who organize themselves to do something. In safe growth as well, second generation crime prevention through environmental design, there's a concept called tipping point is basically, it's where you have too many of activities or individuals, or usually we talk about land use, where those undesirable activities tip over, to what the caring capacity of the neighborhood can still handle. That's when you have problems. So if you have, let's say you have one shooter, you can't be a gang member if you only have one person, but let's say there is one person who's, violent and that, you can probably handle him pretty quickly and, you know, by even like criminal justice system, they'll find him pretty quickly. But if you have, 1% of individuals there, that can be a tipping point then that can make it very dangerous for people and that can cause problems. So, I think it has something to do with that.
We have spoken quite a bit about the challenges to communities, about the serpent underneath the lake, about, you know, cutting off the head of the serpent. But I know that we have touched on the things that communities can do, that neighborhoods can do, to even like change the physical environment and to bring people together outside to build up relationships. So I like to think of it in terms of, you know, what challenges the hero on the quest, on their journey, and who are the helpers, you know, for this journey, and what gifts are they going to give? And one of the things that made a huge difference to me, being brought up on a very concrete-based council estate, was we had one of the biggest wild parks in Europe, about 10 minutes walk away, 15 minutes walk away. That access to nature and a beautiful physical environment made a huge difference. Every house had a big back garden and a small front garden. lots of people loved their gardens and lots of people were out gardening. And so they spoke to each other. And that's how you built up those relationships. Because
they're British.
So British. But it was an integral part of enabling us to form relationships with people. Even if it was just the kids kicking balls into the neighbor's back garden and then having to go around and knock on the door and the neighbor's like, oh, bloody kids with their balls. But you'd have a conversation and that elderly person who might have been very isolated was having kids knock on their door to get the ball out of the back garden. So what do you think, and I know every neighborhood's different, but what do you think are some of the practical gifts that neighborhoods that are people who live in neighborhoods where there is challenge, what are the practical gifts that we could be giving those neighborhoods or that they could be giving themselves, things that they can start to do themselves to make a difference in those neighborhoods?
Yeah, first empower them. So they actually empower them as well as give them skills. That's I think the starting point that, you know, then kind of trickles down as well into other things. But definitely, I mean, those natural neighborhood oases, they are so important for people, especially now. And I actually wrote a blog a few months ago on that as well, because we were talking a lot during COVID about essential workers. And yes, they were essential, they are essential, but also essential places.
You could go
out, and that was, I think, in, well, last time in spring on the Northern Hemisphere, May and so on, you know, after the first lockdowns, like people were like ants in all those points, like, you know, you wanted to get away from everyone. Yeah. Thought you would go somewhere where you would be more isolated, because we're, you know, instructed to socially or physically distance ourselves. And then you had so many, because people were craving nature, like it provided refuge, right?
And then some of the work that you did with Safe Growth, it might not have been you, but Safe Growth did, was where you have the grass verges on pavements or sidewalks that local communities that didn't have access to gardens or whatever were actually planting vegetables and flowers all along those grass verges. So that that gave pleasure, it gave connection, but also it stopped loads of cars parking in the wrong places because they wouldn't go up on those areas now because they were so beautiful. And, you know, it was their mom who planted the cabbages up there, so they knew they'd get a slap from their mom. And that, again, a physical aspect of the neighborhood change the relationships of the community within it. That's remarkable. Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, when you have beautiful areas like this, it's about also ownership and it's about pride, and you're more likely to take care of it. Plus, it was the local people, like the people who live there, who could use what grew there, as well as they took, they planted it there, and they gardened it. So, and yeah, that's actually spread at quite a lot of places. We can see these little patches and, you know, also part of, I guess, transit-oriented development and more walkable neighborhoods, which is also so important, like not just driving, sitting in the car and driving to the shopping mall, but actually walking. And this is, maybe I can bring in our kind of third generation crime prevention through environmental design that Greg and I wrote last year or 2 years ago now, which talks a lot about having opportunities to satisfy the needs on, like, if we look at the Maslow hierarchy, I mentioned the basic needs earlier, shelter, water, you know, also relationships. And the higher you go, the more it is about social relationships and self-actualization and contributing to something beyond just yourself. And I think this is something where we also gain our own satisfaction and pleasure from, like, basically the purpose of life, right? Is, I mean, everyone has different, but hopefully we all want to do something good for the society and for others as well. And this is basically this kind of, I guess, design aspects provide us opportunity for some of those things to happen too,
Actually,
relationships to provide something else.
And some of the most memorable community projects that I've been involved in and helped create, etc., have been community gardening projects that then, you know, where you took over a piece of wasteland that was a real eyesore, looked terrible. And then everybody came together and planted and grew vegetables and flowers there. And then we actually did cooking and we shared recipes. So you had like Somali moms who had planted certain vegetables and shared recipes from their homeland, and Polish and all of these different communities. I mean, literally sharing their roots. And understanding so each other so much better. And it ended up with community cookery books, and so that linked into literacy and again empowerment and festivals. They were just fantastic things from literally somebody looking at a piece of wasteland and saying, let's do something about that.
Exactly. And I think this is you actually raised an important point here, because it's important that these kind of initiatives don't just stop at community garden, for example. We've seen a lot of, like, because community gardens suddenly became such a, you know, hot thing. So everyone started building them, but then they kind of get forgotten in that. But when you start building local economy around it, which actually happened in Holy Grove, they actually had local co-op, which was great. They started selling their own food they produce and so on. And when you combine it with classes and healthy eating and that, it also combines, you know, people who maybe otherwise wouldn't want to get engaged in gardening and that, but maybe they're interested in healthy eating. Maybe maybe there's a sports group that evolves out of that. So the idea is to maybe snowball some initiatives and to actually make it a comprehensive program that addresses the needs of multiple groups within the neighborhood.
So, Matea, every guest has to answer these quick fire questions. And I'm going to add one question to yours. And I think it's linked into the work that you're doing. So you're going to get a special question because you're a special person doing special work. So literally the first question is, what was your favorite story as a child?
Oh, no. Something that stays in mind, sorry, I know I'm kind of going, but it's been so long ago, but I think Robinson Crusoe and those type of stories, because they were like adventurous, you know, they kind of let you explore and so on. So something like that, like island style stories.
When you come to Sweden again, we'll go and camp on a lake, just totally. On the lake. Great, you'll have to come and visit us.
Beautiful.
I love it. I'm an outdoor girl. Who would have known it coming from Birmingham, to be truthful, but I am. The next question isn't a question. I want you to finish a sentence, and the sentence is, creating our own lived stories requires. So creating the stories we want to live, what does that require us to do?
Courage.
Lovely. What sustains you right now? What's keeping you going right now?
Adrenaline.
Through COVID, through lockdowns, it's just
so much work to do that. Yeah, I think it's just adrenaline at the moment. But now also people. I mean, on a more serious note, definitely I think relationships and people. And also kind of, you know, looking into the future and aiming to build a better future, basically. So optimism.
Oh, if I could hug you, I would hug you now.
No, it's been via Zoom, but yeah, definitely. Connecting with people has been so important, like, and including you.
Blew your kiss. What movies or books or series, documentaries would you recommend to the listeners that you've seen that, and it can just be absolute pure, joyful stuff that has no intellectual whatever, or it could be something that has really affected you?
I think if I think of the series, maybe something that I watched recently was The Diagnosis. I'm not sure if you know, it's like
the
Office series.
Diagnosis.
Yeah, it's on Netflix, but what I like it is like, it's a medical style series where basically they ask the wider community about a certain problem, health issue that's very kind of no one knows how to address it. And they ask the wider community to contribute, and then they get all these responses, and then they explore further what the problem was. And sometimes they find the solution, sometimes not. But what I like about this is that they actually engage the wider community. Again, it's people's experience. It's not just about the expertise of doctors. I mean, people have had issues for 10, 20 years, and you know, they didn't get the necessary help. And I'm not saying no blame on doctors, of course not, but it just shows that together we can, you know, offer potentially more solutions. So bringing more people to the table, even in community work, but like here in the diagnosis, just asking people, there's evidence and experience that matter.
Brilliant concept.
Well, who would have thought? It's like, you know, it's like, that's how treatment should work of anything, yeah. Right? So,
and it's so true, yeah. That for any new invention, somebody had to think about something differently.
Yeah, and we're sometimes so kind of, I guess, entangled in the machinery of thinking and in the way we do things that we just don't think, you know, outside the box. And Greg would even say, why do we even need the box? Like, yeah, we shouldn't have limitations at all. I just think, you know, yeah, the universe. Yeah. Can I just bring in a book as well? Because I was thinking about that. And I think The Careless Society, I'm not sure if you know it, by John McKnight.
Let me just say that. The Careless Society, yeah, Community and Its Counterfeits, by John McKnight. Okay, yeah, tell us about
that. Yeah. So, well, I think that is important, and I already kind of brought some stuff earlier. John McKnight was one of the co-developers of asset-based community development, and it actually talks about the importance of not only focusing on the deficiencies of the communities and neighborhoods, but also on the asset, and how can you build on those assets, and identify and recognize them, and then also build on them, and because, you know, we don't necessarily have to start from scratch, whatever issues there might be within the neighborhood. Yeah, so let's build on what we already have. And, you know, and these assets come as in a form of people, individuals, in form of their skills, then parks and so on. So physical assets, like you mentioned earlier, they're very important. And we might have social assets like a community center, school, library. Let's say, you know, what library can do if we have issue with illiteracy, for example, in the neighborhood, like we can have classes there and so on. So let's look at, kind of do a scan of those assets and focus on them and empower the community to continue building on them. And again, it's about community taking over ownership and become empowered rather than relying on, you know, again, on outside agencies and services, because it creates that dependency relationship, and then there's no money, there's different government, those support systems are gone then, and so we can't always rely on them. Let's take them when we can get them, but not become dependent on them.
Lovely. Anyway, thank you for that. Okay, and
you're welcome.
What is the most important story that we should be carrying right now?
Most important story. Yeah. Again, I guess if we think within the framework of COVID, I think the resiliency and adaptability, I think on both individual and neighborhood and societal level, I guess, I think that's something that will help us, you know, get through. And there's been a lot of issues and challenges and people have been suffering, but we need to continue building those concepts also, because I mean, this is not something that's, you know, there's going to be other challenges, and like the society, like, you know, for the past 500,000 years, like, we had to always adapt and change our ways and to survive, and that, and we will survive this as well, but I think we also need to be able to adapt, because I think a lot of people were very challenged when their regular lifestyles were challenged, but I mean, come on, I mean, we need to, like, it's not always going to be the same. Like, it's difficult, it requires effort, but, you know, people are not alone. We help each other, and we need to adapt together.
Yeah.
And,
And this is a special question for you. What
of course
is it? What is it? What do you think it is that makes us human? What makes us human? What trait in us? Hmm.
Um, Well, I mean, if we look at from more biological standpoint, I mean, rational thinking, but I'm not saying rational thinking is something that can always be used to good, to good. We actually need to use our ability to think rationally and to basically to think rationally in order to better not just ourselves but the society. So that's something probably that, you know, differentiates us from other species, because I mean, I love animals, as you know, and they're sentient beings, but this is something that probably differentiates us. That even though sometimes other animals, other species behaving in a more primal way, you know, where they satisfy their needs and so on. I mean, this is something that we should probably move away from, because we do have the ability of rational thinking, and, you know, not just about, like I said, primal
drives.
Yeah, primal type of. Yeah, exactly. Drives. Yeah. The
word was that the word? It's like, yeah, I was trying to find that word earlier. You were trying to find that word there.
I love that.
So many words.
And that, what a lovely thing to finish on, to finish the interview on.
Can I add with a nice quote that I like to?
Yes, finish with that lovely quote.
Like you might know it. It's been probably used many times, but anthropologist Margaret Mead said that never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, is the only thing that ever has. So I think it really speaks to the importance of people working together in order to, you know, achieve the desired changes. And then there's also an addition to this quote where someone says it's not just about the thoughtful and committed citizens, but also organized citizens, because we might have a will and desire, but how can we help communities organize themselves, or how can they organize themselves in order to achieve something? Because it requires that to have a goal, to have a vision, like you said earlier, to know where we're going. So,
well, that is a wonderful place to finish the interview. And I feel like I've eaten a meal of hope after speaking to you. So I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for being an incredible guest on the show, and for sharing your expertise, your knowledge, your experience, and your hope with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Catrice, and great work you're doing. So thank you for sharing the stories and, you know, empowering people through those stories. It's very important.
Thank you. Yeah. Have a lovely day. You take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Thank you, Catrice. Be safe.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. I certainly enjoyed interviewing Matea, and it was fascinating for me to think about stories within neighbourhoods and how those physical change elements can change the story. I'm changing the format a little bit because we're coming up to Easter. So on the 2nd of April, it will not be me talking about the stories that we've heard. I'm actually going to put out the next interview with the next guest, and that is the incredible gardener Alice Fowler, who many of you might know, and certainly I've got some of her books on my shelves. And she's going to be talking about the green, and the green is the main character, in actual fact, in the story of our existence. The natural world is the main character in the story of our existence, because we cannot exist without it. And yet, as Alice and I find out through our conversation, it is the most vital character who actually has no voice. So we want to give the green a voice and fight and campaign to let people realize how vital and important it is. So please join me and Alice on the 2nd of April. And also, please remember to join us on the Instagram page, Unstuffing Our Story. And please remember to subscribe to the podcast. I would really like it if you left some comments about which episode you like the most and which, or rather, the guests that you found the most interesting. I would really, really love that. Sometimes it can feel a little lonely just sitting here by myself. So I would love to connect with you. So subscribe to the channel, join the Instagram page, and get ready to listen to Alice on the 2nd of April. Bye bye for now. Stay safe.